Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where we go beyond the headlines with insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping South Africa's future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching us later today, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up in a compact 30 minutes, the Black Business Council and the impact of load shedding on small businesses. Is expropriation without compensation a tool for justice or a Trojan horse that harms the poor? The digitalization of South Africa's deed system, a step towards efficiency or a potential data disaster? And what communications lessons can businesses learn from the budget speech postponement? It's Monday, the 24th of January. Now, the Black Business Council recently expressed confidence that load shedding will soon be dealt with effectively. But with South Africa's energy crisis far from over and a return to stage 6 at the weekend, back now to stage 4, I'm wondering what's behind the optimism and perhaps more importantly, what impact on small and medium-sized businesses. I want to explore that in a little more detail with the Chief Executive Officer of the Black Business Council, Hanky Matabane. Hanky, a very warm welcome to you. Stage 6 was sudden and unexpected. What kind of impact might this have had on smaller businesses, albeit that it was a weekend?
Yes, thank you very much for having us. We were basically also taken aback and taken by surprise because usually Eskom communicates much better. So it looks like maybe even they were taken by surprise because we wake up, there was zero load shedding, it's stage 3, and all of a sudden now it's stage 6. And the impact obviously is very, very severe, especially for small businesses, because they don't necessarily have the capacity or financial capacity to get themselves the other alternatives like solar generators, diesel, and so on. And as you know, those are costly. And that eats into the profits of small businesses. And if you are a small business, you can't just willy-nilly increase your prices because then people will run away and go to someone else.
And the fact is we're having this conversation and we're now back at stage 4, which is still high. Unless this is resolved quickly, it's going to have a domino effect during the course of the week, won't it?
Yes, definitely it will. We've been engaging with Eskom leadership, and maybe just to go back to our first question, we still have confidence in the leadership of Eskom. We listen to their presentation. They are not blaming any other thing but engineering challenges. They are not blaming wet coal like we've had before. So we still think that they are doing a great job, but we hope this stage 4 is not going to be prolonged for the whole week, because then the impact will be big. And then we hope going to stage 6 is not going to be coming back again, because that then is a serious thing. We don't want to get used to stage 6, or we don't even want to get used to load shedding at all. So we hope the S promise, like they did when they broke the record of 300 days, they indicated that they will be able to solve the challenges during the weekend, and then they did. And now they said they'll solve the challenges during the week. So by Friday, we'll be back to normal. Mm. So we hope we're not going to go back to getting used to having no power. It's not a good thing for the country.
It's certainly
our country that is struggling with the economic growth. We can't go back there.
You're certainly right in that respect. And I do acknowledge your endorsement of Eskom leadership, and it was engineering failures. It was a domino effect of a number of failures at different plants. It does raise questions about Eskom's current performance and reform efforts, though, doesn't it? So many of us thought that we were out of the woods, and all of a sudden to go to stage 6, as we've agreed, out of nowhere at all, surely does raise critical questions about whether that reform plan is working sufficiently, or if there are aspects of it that need to be re-examined.
Yes, I fully agree with you. It's a setback that we never anticipated ourselves also as business, and we hope it doesn't repeat itself. And we are also aware, if you're running any business, you'll know there are always going to be inherent risk with running a certain type of organization. And unfortunately, if those risks materialize, then we have got a big problem. But again, we were expecting proper communication. We were expecting proper planning and an interaction with Eskom, because as far as we are concerned, Eskom is the only organization that can stop load shedding. We've had people saying renewable energy and all those things, but those things for us is for the future, it's not for now. As things stand now, Eskom is the only organization that can stop load shedding, and we have to support them.
Surely renewable energy is not a thing for the future, that it needs to happen in tandem with the reform process that's happening at Eskom right now. Renewable energy is critical, isn't it?
It is, yeah, but I'm just saying for the sake of load shedding, it does not necessarily help. But we have to implement it in parallel as well, where we're resolving the issues at Eskom so that we are ready for the future when renewable energy can have base load. Because our challenge in South Africa is that currently, because we don't have enough battery storage, we cannot use the solar system as base load. And it has proven last week, for example, those who thought they were off the grid, I'm talking about households, they got the shock of their life that they can't be off the grid because it was raining the whole week. And because we don't have enough capacity
Right.
for storage, people were off the grid, where people didn't have electricity.
Let me ask you one last question very quickly, please. What's the best advice then, right now, that you would give to your constituency in terms of the next couple of days and dealing with stage four?
The advice is just to say, let's be patient and let's give Eskom leadership an opportunity to resolve the issues. But I think as businesses, we need to then try and plan a little bit better so that we can accommodate the potential challenges that we may experience the whole week.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Hanky Matabane, who's the Chief
Thank you.
Executive Officer of the Black Business Council.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the debate over expropriation without compensation continues in many respects to divide South Africa. Supporters argue it's a necessary corrective for past injustices, and there are critics that are warning it could devastate the economy and harm the very people it claims to uplift. I'm in conversation now with Nolutando Hlophoi from the Foundation for Rights of Expression and Equality. And she believes that EWC, as we call it, might be more harmful than helpful. A very warm welcome to you. And you've labelled or called EWC an anti-poor Trojan horse. What are you trying to say?
What we're actually saying there it is that this bill, it's not actually, just in simple terms, it's not meant to empower the poor. Just to put it in simple terms there. And as we know, and as we've seen it before, this kind of a bill, actually, it was done before by our neighboring countries such as Zimbabwe, and it left masses in poverty. As much as also the bill, as we had known, or rather as we had said now, that it's not meant to be harmful, or rather it's the intention of it is not what it actually as it seems, which is quite confusing because it does say expropriation without any compensation. So that on its own, it tells us a lot that the government wants to actually, of course, take the land and then not actually give any compensation to the masses. And as we know currently, as South African youth, if I were to actually point out that, don't necessarily, I don't say they don't need the land. South African youth needs a viable economy where, in actual fact, the investors are able to invest and are able to create job opportunities. With that being said, with a bill like this, it does, to a degree, actually brings about fear to international investors, as we have seen what it has caused after that, actually with the US thing.
But there is an argument, isn't there, for explaining that land expropriation in one respect or another, doesn't matter what the language is essential for addressing historical injustice.
I understand that. However, whenever you are, for instance, if you are selling something to us as a public, there must be a way that you do that without actually causing it to be inflammatory. Because remember, as a country, we need its foreign investors. We also do need the current people who are working the land. As someone who resides in a place where I'm surrounded by beautiful farms, when actual fact, if I were a farmer, if I would hear this, I would actually panic. And as much as it is a norm that it was done to redress, or rather to address what happened before, the way that it has been done or the way that it has been launched, it sounds like rather it comes as a force that many, or if I was a farmer, I wouldn't be ready for that. As much as the bill doesn't say that it will go and actually grab land from the people who were working the land, because the bill also talks about land that is sitting and not being used, right? But in all of that, the point is, the way that it was introduced, it sounded like it will come for my land if I were to be a farmer. For that matter, there were times, in fact, that we, when you read deeper, you understand that does this also mean, if also I'm a homeowner, the government might actually want to own that land. Bearing in mind that currently the government is the biggest owner when it comes to land in this country.
So is it the bill itself which is problematic, or simply the way in which it's been explained?
I'd say both. Why? Firstly, the bill itself, of course, it does explain in a sense of no, the land, it won't be a land that is actually used. It will be a land that is sitting there. Let's say, for instance, if I bought the land and not using the land for the past, 50 years or so, the government will actually take that land without any compensation because the land is not being used. Then now, also at the same time, like I said to you, if you are actually looking to sustain or also to actually have more growth in the country, there must be a way that you communicate that. As opposed to, I do believe, for that matter, as an organization, knowing the history and also the pattern of this current government, whenever bills like this, they bring them into table, there's always an intention behind it. And Jerry Max, we would be naive to think that the intent was not meant for what it actually has done, meaning the consequences of the after of this bill. So I'm saying the two, the introduction or how it was launched, and also the bill in itself, there are some parts of it that actually aren't, I would say, that are not good for our economy at this point.
So let's pick up on that thread then. Is there any evidence so far to suggest that EWC is going to impact local and foreign investment, or is it still in the realm, do you think, of sentiment?
It's still in the realm of sentiment. However, though, whenever, for instance, currently there are some, for instance, political organizations that we know, they are more about land, right? Like the EFFs and the likes. They've actually taken this and made it to seem like, and also this, our president is seen as the hero who actually now becoming the Mugabe 2.0. What does that tell you, though, Jeremy, that truly this bill is seen as such, doing what Mugabe has done before? It is a sentiment of now. For instance, we haven't necessarily seen this coming into action per se. Do you know what I mean?
So let me ask you this then. Are there sectors of the economy that you think, that your organization thinks, would be hardest hit if this was to be implemented widely?
Agriculture. And that's actually the biggest one. It feeds us. And we also feed the other countries through our agriculture right now. For instance, if I was, again, a farm owner, I might think of actually selling my land because out of fear. So I'm saying that this bill in itself, it will affect the most our agriculture from our perspective. And even other, for instance, what I mean is, if as an investor I wanted to actually buy a land to build, or even if it's a warehouse, then in that way I might actually be scared because I'll be thinking, you know what, if I do buy this land and build this warehouse, at some point the government would want to actually take it back.
So what would your recommendation be to policymakers on this issue? Is there any way to recalibrate the debate to take the fear away?
I think first and foremost, our current government should understand, whenever there are bills such as these, and even like the Bella bill and the NHI bills, as much as there might, for instance, if you're talking about the NHI, there might not be launched as in they're actually happening in process. Those bills actually, and the two bills particularly, the NHI and this one, there must be a way that we launch them in a manner that are not actually harmful. And also, if it's not harmful, the wording in itself and what the bill entails, and actually the campaign and how the bill is launched, it is quite sensitive in how our current government actually does it. And also, at this point, we need bills, firstly, Jeremy, that will empower our economy, and that will not actually take away or rather create even more hurdle when it comes to our prospect of our economy. So I'd say the government should be focusing on those bills that will create more influx in growing this economy at this present moment. And as we know, currently the same government wanted to take 2% from us to actually help and fund the expenses that the government has. There's a counterproductiveness into this whole thing. The government wants to having these bills, but at the same time wants us as ordinary South African to fund the expenses of not just of these bills, but the government's expenses.
One senses this debate has still got a long way to run. I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Nolutando Lepoi from the Foundation for Rights of Expression and Equality. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's deeds registry is undergoing a major digital overhaul, promising to improve efficiency and reduce fraud. But as the property sector moves online, there would obviously be concerns around access, security and implementation. Let's discuss this a little further with Kagiso Mahlangu, a property law expert at the law firm CMS. Kagiso, so first of all, what are the main risks of fraud in property transactions and digitization? How is it going to address them?
Yeah, I think whenever we are using technology as a tool, right, we know that it's a powerful enabler, but it does open us up to cyber risks and security concerns, especially when it comes to property transactions and registrations that we see at the deeds registry's office. We know that those involve highly sensitive information. And I think what becomes quite important is that when we're seeing this move to digitize the registration process is to ensure that there is systems that are put in place to protect that information. And I think this requires a multi-phased approach to ensure that all stakeholders within the deeds office, those who are going to be using the system, take up a best practice, if you would, to secure the use of the system. We see it all the time with digitization. Encryption can be used, multi-factor authentications can be used. And I think it will be quite important to ensure that there is a regular security audit that is done to ensure that information is secured, and we aren't at risk of information being leaked.
So sensitive data, as you correctly say, is at stake. Is there an indication from the deeds office that those cybersecurity measures are in place to combat the concerns that you've raised?
So with the Amendment Act, what it does is that it gives the Chief Registrar of Deeds power to issue directives that would, I guess, influence the implementation and ensuring that security measures are put in place. We are currently using, digitized systems within the deeds office because we're able to track deeds, as an example. We're able to conduct deeds office searches. But I think that the directives that are issued by the registrar, I think, would be more guiding in terms of seeing what is going to be put in place, basically, to ensure that such sensitive information is secured.
There is a move, as you say, towards digitization partially already. Have you experienced any problems so far?
There's always going to be problems. I think, sometimes what happens is that systems become offline, and that becomes a challenge because we know that registrations are quite important and they do influence a lot of daily lives of people, as well as registrations that we see in the corporate sector. So there are challenges, especially when it comes to things becoming offline. But I don't think that should be a deterrent to moving towards digitization.
That's obviously a good argument, but the counter argument to that perhaps is that the system could disadvantage people who lack digital literacy or even reliable internet access. Is that being taken sufficiently into consideration?
That is so true. And I think with every move in digitization, it is important to ensure that everyone, the man on the street and everyone, is able to use the system efficiently and ensure that we're not locking people out unintended with the intention of using a system that we know is going to provide great efficiencies to the process. So I think it does become quite important to ensure that in implementing the system, that the necessary training is given and that, the system becomes affordable for maybe attorneys or users that need to use the system in order to do these registrations.
To the best of your knowledge, does this new system integrate with existing land reform programs or are they going to remain separate?
We don't know at this stage because there haven't been any directives issued in that regard. But I think it will be quite interesting and important for it to do so, because we know that land is quite an important and topical issue in South Africa.
What about penalties or consequences for non-compliance with the new system? What is the legal profession hearing?
The legal profession is hearing that, I mean, one of the key issues or directives that needs to be issued is who's going to have access to the system. You always have to ensure that the users of the systems are those who are meant to be using that system. So there are penalties in terms of people who may, find a way to use the system when they're not supposed to. So there are fines and, imprisonment penalties that can be implemented. So I think it will be quite important to ensure that those are applied consistently, because I think with the digitization of the registration process, it does become quite important to ensure that people who need to use the system are using the system. And we're not opening ourselves up to cyber risks of someone, an unauthorized user, as an example, using the system.
How is determination worked out for who has access or not?
So I think it will be probably based on who attends to registrations. What we're seeing now is if you're an attorney, if you're a notary, if you're a conveyancer, those people are authorized to attend to registrations. I think it would be have to limit it to that profession. And obviously, anyone who does go into the deeds office to get information would have to interface with the system somewhat. But I think that key would be having professionals within the deeds registration process being authorized to use the system.
So just a quick one then, what's the expected timeline for full adoption, and is there a significant hurdle that might delay it? Again, what have you been hearing?
So we don't know the timeline right now. The Amendment Act does provide for a transitional provisions, meaning that whilst we await the directives to be issued by the Chief Registrar, we will be using the current system that we're using daily. I think one thing that we can't ignore is that this is a mammoth task. Registration processes are quite important, not to toot our own horn, but I mean, South Africa has quite a stringent registration process. So I think that ensuring that the necessary measures are put into place in terms of the functional requirements, the technical specifications, and the standards that are going to govern the system, it's nothing that you can rush. And I think that it's something that is important to ensure that it's done properly first time around. And whilst we don't have a timeline, I think then it becomes quite important for the Chief Registrar to get on with it, because we're all excited and we're looking forward to it.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Kagiso Mahlangu, property law expert at the law firm CMS.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, for the first time in 30 years, as you well know, South Africa's budget speech was postponed, and that sparked market anxiety and political speculation. Today, in his weekly letter to South Africans, President Ramaphosa saying, "The events of last week presented us with an opportunity to raise the level of understanding among South Africans around the budget and what it means for them." He goes on to write that considerable public interest around the budget speech, including from many South Africans, was greatly encouraging. It is our hope, he goes on to say, that this sparks a necessary national conversation on how we'll fund our national priorities and the trade-offs that will need to be made. It is good spin. But beyond the economic implications, the situation also provides a case study in crisis communication. And that's the avenue that I want to explore today. I'm in conversation with Bradley Howland, Chief Executive Officer of the marketing agency Alchemy Collective, about the key communication lessons that businesses can take from the event. So, Bradley, having said that, in your opinion, then, what were the biggest communication failures or mishaps surrounding this postponement?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think there were a couple of things that really were almost a textbook case of how lack of communication can really shape public perception. So I think the first thing was that the controlling of the narrative early didn't really take place. You saw a delay that happened where politicians, opposition parties, unions, and also I guess the general public were able to frame the story before Treasury could. And in those instances where if you don't frame your story first and own it, somebody else will. It also then spoke ultimately to the idea that speed does matter. When you don't take control of that narrative quickly, you ultimately start eroding that credibility that comes with it as well. So whether it is government, whether you're a business in a similar situation, that sort of agility and speed is almost paramount to making sure that you're able to control that narrative. I think, you know, the one thing that is really important as well is that there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from this. But ultimately, the one thing that comes out in these types of situations, especially when it comes to crisis communications, is your reputation becomes a lot harder to rebuild and maintain after something like this has happened. So, yes, it's created great public dialogue and dialogue across political parties and unions. But the biggest issue here is now the expectation is significantly higher for Treasury in this instance to actually regain that trust ahead of the 12th of March budget speech that is scheduled.
Bradley, it's not just about reputation, of course. It has a direct impact on the economy. Moments after this postponement, as we well know, albeit there has been a recovery, the Rand was negatively impacted.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when it comes to something like that as well, it's all about the framing and context. In this instance as well, is that what we saw is that Treasury itself didn't really frame the whole VAT increase properly, which was obviously leaked to the public shortly after the actual thing itself. The way that it was seen is that this was going to be ultimately a financial burden rather than some sort of long-term economic strategy. And so in that instance, what you saw was that there was a level of misinformation and assumption that was created because of that information vacuum. And that in turn has a massive knock-on effect in our economy and obviously on the Rand itself. And I think in those instances, it's imperative. It's not just about what is happening. It's the why that really matters. It's that detail and clarity that can help manage these kind of situations better to avoid a knock on the Rand, to avoid a knock on business itself. And I think that was something that was missing in that moment.
Your point is very well taken, but you really are speaking like a marketing and communications professional. I'll come straight back at you, Bradley, and say, whichever way you try to sell this, it was always going to be a very difficult message to impart and would inevitably be met with pushback.
Agreed. Absolutely. I think we're living in a cost of living crisis at the moment. And I think that is something that whether it's government or anybody else needs to be acutely aware of, is that people are highly sensitive at the moment. And so when relaying a message like this, it is critical that in these moments that it is framed in a way that makes people understand what the economic priorities are, how, whether it's an increase in the VAT or other measures that are being taken in the budget, that these are going to be done to help in the end of the day and in long term consumers and their pockets. And I think that was missing from the entire narrative, is that people are very scared at the moment, that things are getting ridiculously expensive. I think what's happening in terms of the concerns around what's happening overseas in the West is amplifying that concern for a lot of people. And so it is about making sure that government is in tune with that feeling and emotion that the public has at this point in time. I think that was missed last week a little bit. And it, in turn, I guess it also shows why, if we look at the GNU, why it is working, is that there is this robust debate and pushback where there is that sort of awareness and sensitivity that people are looking for more rather than just another price increase on things.
What do you think the key lessons then that businesses can apply to their own crisis management strategies, learning from this fiasco last week?
I think number one, get ahead of the story. When I was younger, when I sort of studied crisis comms in school, the first thing they taught you was that you own your story first before somebody else does. And I think for business, when you're dealing with a sensitive issue, a product recall, you know, a price increase on goods, it's important that you're owning that narrative first. The second thing as well is to also make sure that you are giving that context to everything. So if people just say, okay, well, this is, you know, why we're recording a product, this is why we're increasing a price on goods, that's not enough. It's the why that really does matter. And it's the thing that's going to buy that credibility and trust in your brand. I think the other thing that is quite critical, and we've seen this in the past with a couple of incidences where brands have sort of failed, is the idea that any sort of delay, even if you want to try and perfect your message, is a loss of control. And it is about that preparedness. Good crisis management is ultimately about being as prepared as possible for every possible scenario. And I think a lot of brands don't do that. They become very reactive in situations. And that reactive approach often means a delay in things. And that vacuum ultimately is going to create opportunity for critics to actually come to the fore.
Well, let's see if key lessons have been learnt ahead of March 12. Bradley Howland, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the marketing agency Alchemy Collective. And that's all for today on this edition of MoneyWeb at Midday. As always, thank you so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more reporting and analysis of the stories shaping our economy in 30 minutes.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.